report and check out all they will present arguments of the petition. Other later.
I'm sorry. My mistake. For later.
May I please report, I'm Pat Holloway, and I represent myself here today. That being the situation, I think I'm required to confess at the outset by a very valid maxim that I have approved for a client, and I so confess. But I would like this court to know that my client at least has enough sense, particularly after consultation with me, to be very grateful for the privilege.
Mr. Holloway, I'm having trouble hearing you.
I said I would like the court to know that my client at least has enough sense to be grateful for the privilege to be here today in this mandamus action against a court of appeals. And now also say that if any member of this court does not understand the facts as I try to relate them or disagrees with anything I try to say about the law, I would very much appreciate the court's objections or comments or questions. I'd like to begin by referring to a case that I did not specifically cite in my brief, although I referred to the principle. And the case is Strake versus First Court of Appeals, a decision by this court in 1986, reported in 704 Southwestern 2nd, 746. In that case, Justice Wallace, speaking for the court, said this: in reviewing by writ of mandamus an action of the Court of Appeals, our focus remains on the point of origin. If we determine that the ruling at the point of origin was correct, and if the Court of Appeals has ruled contrary to that by mandamus, then the Court of Appeals has abused its discretion in issuing its writ of mandamus, and we will correct that ruling by a writ of mandamus directed to the Court of Appeals. What I think that means is that in this case, the proper focus of this court's attention, our attention, is on the ruling of District Judge Ryan. If this court determines that the ruling of Judge Ryan was legally correct for any one or more of the reasons, independent reasons he set forth in his conclusion, then I do not think it is of controlling importance here that the Court of Appeals also exceeded its jurisdiction by issuing a writ of mandamus against a final appealable judgment then in the process of appeal to the court, and it is not of controlling importance that the Court of Appeals also clearly, in my view, exceeded its jurisdiction in granting writs of prohibition and injunction, because the appellate courts have no power to issue such writs except to protect their own jurisdiction or protect their own judgments. And here, the Court of Appeals had no judgment to protect because it had dismissed the appeal from the Walker judgment that's in issue here. But if this court is convinced that the district judge's ruling is correct, I hope that the errors of the Court of Appeals will not go unnoticed, because the rulings of the Court of Appeals with respect to its mandamus jurisdiction and its prohibition jurisdiction are clearly contrary to the existing precedent of this court. The case involves issues as to the validity and status of assignments of cases, particular cases, by the presiding judge of the administrative region and by the presiding judge of the local district courts in a multi-district county like Dallas County. This case began in 1979. It was filed in the 193rd Judicial District Court of Dallas County with Judge Snodgrass presiding. It was removed the same year to the bankruptcy court. On January 18, 1980, the parties entered into a stipulation providing for the remand of the case to the district court under an agreement whereby both parties would go to the presiding judge and ask him to the presiding judge of the district court, the 193rd court, to ask the presiding judge of the first judicial district, which included Dallas, to appoint a retired or visiting judge to handle, to try the case. The agreement further provided that if Judge Snodgrass did not do so, the remand would not be effective and the case would remain in the bankruptcy court where it would be tried before a jury. Parties went back to Judge Snodgrass. He entered an agreed order in which he requested the presiding judge of the administrative district to assign a retired judge to the case. A retired judge was assigned by the presiding judge, Judge Purifoy. He assigned Judge Long to try the case. Judge Long tried the settlement issues, ruled in favor of the settlement agreement, and enforced it. On appeal to the Court of Appeals, that was reversed because the Brownings, although they had not asked for a jury trial or paid their jury fee, they reversed for lack of a jury trial. This court refused the writ in that case in 1981 with a short opinion concerning the accord and satisfaction issue. The case went back to the district court. The presiding judge, Judge Purifoy, then appointed another retired judge to hear the case because Judge Long had refused to said he was unable to proceed further. At that point in time, Judge Purifoy appointed retired Judge Horowitz to sit for this case specifically, and only this case, in the 109th Third Court. That assignment was made under Article 200A of the former 200A, same statute that was involved in part in this case, court's decision in the Pressler case. Retired Judge Horowitz then tried the settlement issues, entered a directed verdict in favor of the Brownings at the close of the Holloway Humble evidence. We filed a motion for rehearing, which was pending before him. At that point in time, while the motion for reconsideration was pending before retired Judge Horowitz, and after he had set the trial on the merits for trial, Judge B. Brown Walker entered a consolidation order purporting to consolidate the Browning case pending before Judge Horowitz into Judge Walker's 162nd District Court. That order of consolidation was entered in a Fairway receivership case, which was then proceeding in Judge Walker's court. It was entered without notice or hearing. As soon as we found out about the order of consolidation, the humble attorney, Mr. James Cahey, went to the presiding judge of the administrative district, Judge Obart, with the attorneys for the Brownings and requested a hearing to have the case sent back to retired Judge Horowitz sitting in the 193rd. Judge Obart heard the matter briefly and then decided that he should not decide this issue, that it should be decided by the local presiding judge of Dallas County rather than by the presiding judge of the administrative district. All that happened on June 10th, Thursday, June 10th. Mr. Cahey then went to look for the presiding judge of Dallas County. That was Judge Dan Gibbs. Judge Gibbs was sick, home in bed. So Mr. Cahey asked the clerk personnel who was the acting presiding judge in the absence and illness of Judge Gibbs. That was Judge Meade. So he went to Judge Meade, asked for a hearing for the following day. Judge Meade said, yes, I am the acting presiding judge under the bylaws because I am presiding judge-elect of the Dallas County judge. So Mr. Cahey filed a petition, served it on the other side, and we had a contested hearing on Friday, June 11th before Judge Meade.
What year was this?
This was fall 1982. After a contested hearing in which the Brownings participated fully, Judge Meade, as the acting presiding judge of the Dallas County District Courts, set aside the order of consolidation of Judge Walker and ordered the case transferred back to the presiding judge. The presiding judge in the Browning case, retired Judge Horowitz, who had been specially assigned to the case by the presiding judge of the administrative district. Judge Meade gave effect to the order of the presiding judge and followed the Cleveland versus Ward doctrine that says that the court where the same case is brought in courts of concurrent jurisdiction, the first court has dominant jurisdiction. Judge Meade also set aside at the same time an order of transfer, which had been issued by regular Judge Snodgrass of the 193rd. That also was issued without notice. Judge Walker had gone to Judge Snodgrass ex parte and asked him to sign an order of transfer to give effect to Walker's order of consolidation. And Judge Snodgrass, who had no jurisdiction in the case because he had released and relinquished all jurisdiction when he had asked the presiding judge to assign the case to a retired judge, he had in that agreed order specified that if the presiding judge assigned it to a retired judge and that judge became unable to continue with the case, jurisdiction over the case would remain with the presiding judge, who would appoint a substitute retired judge to hear the remainder of the case. And that is what exactly happened, as it turned out.
Mr. Holloway, you're of course at liberty to use your time any way you want to, but a lot of us are familiar with, you know, the history of your case. You've been in the United States Fifth Circuit and the Dallas Court of Appeals and up here and in Lee County and back here. I mean, if this history relates to what's in front of us right now, fine. But
I think it's the crux of what is in front of us, and it's a question of whether or not the presiding judge, the assignments by the presiding judge of both the district and the county, have effect, or whether Judge Walker could overrule those orders.
But hadn't that been ruled on?
No, Your Honor, that issue certainly has not been ruled on. It hasn't been ruled on by any court. That issue could not be brought up in the civil rights action in which Judge Sanders abstained on all state court issues. It was not brought up in Browning versus Navarro, the federal enforcement action, because Judge Sanders specifically abstained and remanded to the state courts any issue, any state law issue. This is purely a state law issue.
Now, whether it was brought up or not, when you appealed to the Dallas Court of Appeals after you lost in federal court, wasn't that an issue that should have been litigated, whether or not Judge D. Brown Walker had the authority to do what he did?
Yes, Your Honor, that issue could have been brought up on appeal, and the...
Not only could have, must
was.
Have.
Not, I don't believe in the appeal it was framed in terms of jurisdictional issues, because it wasn't necessary to do so on the direct appeal. But the propriety of, there's no question but that the propriety of these various orders was attempted to be litigated in the appeal. And the dismissal of the appeal means that I cannot bring up any issues that either were or could have been raised in that direct appeal unless they are of jurisdictional stature. But if they are of jurisdictional stature, which this clearly is, the dismissal of the appeal does not deprive me of the right to bring that issue up, because a collateral attack can be made upon a judgment which is void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. This court so ruled in Browning versus Plocky, which is just restates what the law in Texas has always been, which is that if a court does not have subject matter jurisdiction over the particular case, that judgment is void, and that judgment is subject to collateral attack or attack by bill of review, even if it has been affirmed by the Supreme Court of Texas. This court has repeatedly held, at least five times, and courts of appeal have held, that the affirmance of a void judgment, even by this court, does not impart validity to the judgment, because the affirmance itself is void, because the underlying judgment was void.
Who determines in what state whether or not that judgment is void?
I beg your pardon?
Who determines the voidness of the judgment, one that's been reviewed by the Court of Appeals in this court? And you're arguing that even if we passed on it and we said judgment is affirmed, you're saying you can still attack its invalidity at some point and say it was void.
On the grounds of voidness, it can be attacked, and that is what this court has repeatedly held.
Let me tell you my frustration with this case. I'm very upfront with it. Is there any end to this litigation?
Is there any end?
Correct. And in terms of, aren't you charged with the responsibility of bringing up all issues and all alleged errors at your first opportunity and not be entitled to so many bites at the apple?
Well, I've never had a bite at this apple. No court has ever ruled on these issues. no appellate court has looked at this judgment and the dismissal of my appeal because I attempted to defend myself in an enforcement action in the federal court does not deprive me of the right to bring up jurisdictional errors, even though those issues were raised on appeal or attempted to be raised on appeal. A collateral attack can be maintained on a judgment which is void. And until this litigation will end, when a court decides that I do not have the right to collaterally attack it, that it is not void, then the litigation will end. Because even though the affirmance of a void judgment does not serve to validate it, if it's subsequently attacked collaterally or bill of review, and the court there decides contrary to that, that it is not a void judgment, then that judgment is res judicata as to whether or not the judgment is void or not. But a judgment which is void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction can be collaterally attacked. In this court, starting in 1851 in Mills versus Bagley and on down through Chambers versus Hodges and up into this century, has said that if a judgment is void, in fact is void, either because the judge was disqualified or lack of personal service or lack of subject matter jurisdiction, even though that is erroneously affirmed on appeal to this court and this court writes an opinion affirming the judgment of the trial court, later a party can come in and say, whoops, that judge was disqualified, he was related to the parties, or there was no personal service and it is void. If a judgment is void, it is subject to collateral attack, notwithstanding its affirmance by this court. And this judgment was void because Judge D. Brown Walker simply did not have jurisdiction over the case. His case, he cannot, unless this court rules that a regular district judge can overrule a special assignment by the presiding judge of the administrative region, the assignment of a case by the local presiding judge of a multi-district county, then Judge Walker did not have jurisdiction over this case. And the Brownings legally were charged with knowledge of that because they went before Judge Meade and they made no objection to his jurisdiction as presiding judge, and they litigated before Judge Meade the issue of whether Judge Walker had jurisdiction over this case, and they lost. And they didn't appeal. They didn't file a writ of mandamus or anything except go out, send Judge Walker out Saturday night to get Judge Gibbs to sign an order, which he later recanted. And there was no notice or hearing of that proceeding, and that proceeding is void for a number of reasons, including the fact that Judge Dan Gibbs, as he acknowledged, was not the acting presiding judge at the time because of his illness. And we had no opportunity to litigate that issue. So the only time the issue of the validity or voidness of this subsequent judgment has been litigated, we won in front of Judge Meade. And that has never been set aside. And what they are doing is making a collateral attack on Judge Meade's unappealed judgment. He was the duly presiding judge. They litigated the issue and they lost. And then they went ahead and went to trial before a judge that they knew or had to know didn't have jurisdiction over the case.
I assume that Dallas County would be governed by the same statute as Harris County. Isn't there a provision that any district judge in Dallas County can sit for any other district judge?
I don't know if there, you know, whether there's a specific provision in the local rules, but there's Rule 330, which is what they're relying on. The general rule says that a judge may sit for another judge or another court, but Judge Walker didn't purport to sit for the 193rd District Court. He purported to just grab the case away from Judge Harless. And what he did was not authorized even by the broad terms of Rule 330. And Rule 3, which is all they're relying on, is Rule 330. And that is a general rule that really can't have jurisdictional stature. It can't have jurisdictional effect by virtue of the rules themselves. Rule 816 says these rules shall not be construed to extend jurisdiction of the courts. And that's what they're trying to do in this case, is to use Rule 330 to override Article 200A and Article 200B, which specifically give the presiding judge the authority to make case assignments. Article 200A says, "It shall be the duty of such judge so assigned by the presiding judge of the administrative district to serve in such court to which he may be assigned unless for good cause presented by him in writing to the presiding judge of his administrative district, he shall be relieved of such assignment by such presiding judge." Now, I submit that it is a matter of simple statutory interpretation. That means that only where a presiding judge has assigned a particular judge, a retired judge, to sit in a particular case, that only that presiding judge of the district can remove him or relieve him. Because it says the only way he can get relieved is by the presiding judge. Here, Judge Walker purported to relieve
him. Did Judge Walker sign a transfer order?
He signed an order, what he called an order of consolidation. Now, that order of consolidation was void on its face because our Rule 174 says cases which are pending before the court may be consolidated. That gives a court the power only to consolidate two or more cases pending before his court. Judge Walker just reached out and got a case that was pending before Judge Harless in Judge Harless's court and brought it into his court. Well,
hypothetically, you have two cases filed, one in the 162nd and one in the 193rd. They both involve the same subject matter and the same parties. Motion to consolidate is filed. Cannot the judge in the case having the lower cause number sign an order of consolidation, thereby pulling it out of one court into his court?
In the situation you have put, I think that in Dallas County anyway, the order of the local rules 1.1F specifically provides that an order of consolidation must be filed in the earliest case filed. So the answer to your question in Dallas County is no. If you're saying could it be filed in the junior court, it has to be filed in the senior court.
Well, the oldest, I said the judge in the court in which
with
the lowest filed case is located, can't he bring the case from the other court into his court and join it, consolidate it with the lower numbered case?
I question whether a court can reach out and grab another case out of another judge's court unless both of them agreed to it. If they both agreed to it, I think he could do so. But I don't think...
Well, was this pursuant to a motion for consolidation?
It was pursuant to a motion, but the motion was never served on us. The receiver filed a motion in Judge Walker's court, but we were never served with it.
And did Judge Walker have the lower number?
No, lower number. He had junior case, the most recently filed case. He had the case that under Cleveland versus Ward had no jurisdiction. Cleveland versus Ward says in that situation, the court where the earliest court, is the court of dominant jurisdiction and has that case to the exclusion of the later court. And that the later court does not have jurisdiction over the case. And mandamus will lie, as this court has recently ruled, because the junior court simply does not have jurisdiction. And that was our situation. We had a classic Cleveland versus Ward situation, where the 193rd court was the court of dominant jurisdiction. Judge Walker did not have jurisdiction under the Cleveland versus Ward doctrine that this court has many times followed.
That's by the way, you're saying that in this motion for consolidation, when Judge D. Brown Walker consolidated a case pending in Judge Harless's court, that you were not served with a motion for consolidation and you're representing to the court that there was no hearing and there was an ex parte. Is that your argument?
That's not my argument. That is my argument, Your Honor, but it's not just my representation. That's what District Judge Ryan found, and they don't deny that. There's no dispute about the facts. The facts in this case are found by Judge Ryan, specified by Judge Ryan. They have never denied that. So, yes, that is a fact. There was no notice, and Judge Ryan found it as a fact, and there wasn't any evidence to the contrary. But there was no notice. There was no notice of any of these orders signed that vests the court to vest jurisdiction in Judge Walker's court. All of those orders were ex parte. The only contested hearing was the contested hearing before Judge Meade, at which Judge Meade entered a final order and judgment which concluded the entire controversy before him and determined that Judge Walker did not have jurisdiction and ordered the case back to Judge Harless, specifically set aside Judge Walker's order of consolidation, specifically set aside Judge Snodgrass's ex parte order of transfer, which was just based on the order of consolidation. The only basis for all of that was was the original, for any claim of jurisdiction of Judge Walker was that order of consolidation. Now, the order of consolidation was void for the reason that I've said, that it did not comply either with Rule 174A or the Dallas Local County Rule. But that order of consolidation, which is the only claim of jurisdiction of Judge Walker, was set aside by the Dallas Court of Appeals when it vacated the receivership order. So in addition to everything I said today, Judge Walker did not get jurisdiction, or if he had it, he lost it, when the Dallas Court of Appeals vacated the receivership order. The receiver's motion for consolidation says it's based on the receivership statute. And even though they wasn't served on us or anything, and Judge Walker's order of consolidation is based on the receivership order that he'd previously entered. That receivership was vacated on June 18th by the Dallas Court of Appeals. And I have submitted in my briefs the cases in Texas which hold that reversal of an order reverses and vacates all dependent orders. The order of consolidation was dependent upon the receivership order. And that receivership order was vacated by the Dallas Court of Appeals. And when that happened, that vacated the order of consolidation, which is the sole basis for the claim of jurisdiction of Judge Walker. A reversal relates back in time to the date of the order vacated or reversed. The receivership order was dated May 28th. Based on that receivership order, on June 10th, the orders of consolidation. On June 18th, the receivership order, the order creating the receivership is vacated. That vacated the June 10th order of consolidation and put the parties back in the position they were on May 28th before the receivership order was entered.
What are you asking this court to order the Court of Appeals in Dallas?
What am I asking it to order? I'm asking this court to rule, in accordance with the Straight case, that the legal, one or more of the substantive legal conclusions of Judge Ryan is correct. And pursuant to that ruling, I'm asking this court to issue a mandamus against the Court of Appeals directing it to vacate its writs issued on July 28th. That, of course, is not an affirmance of the judgment of the district court, but I assume that in the appeal, this court would be, the Dallas Court of Appeals would give wait to this court's ruling on the legal issues involved.
Let me see if I understand. What would the posture be then if we do exactly what you're asking us to do? What happens next? What's the status? What needs to be done in order to bring this litigation to an end? A final conclusion after all these years?
Now that won't bring it to a final conclusion.
I know it won't, but tell me what needs, from your perspective, what would you do?
From my perspective, then the Brownings claim would be, the lawsuit would be right where it's always been, pending in the 193rd District Court. But the appeal would still be pending. Their appeal would still be pending from the District Court's ruling. But if this court rules that the District Court's judgment was legally correct, then the Dallas Court of Appeals would be obliged to affirm the judgment of Judge Ryan.
We're ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Zach Ayers will present argument from respondents.
May it please the court, my name is Jack Ayers. I represent the respondents and the various parties in interest, primarily the Browning family, the estate of the late William W. Browning, Jr., deceased, his wife and children. I would like to simplify, if I might, what I think the relevant legal issue is before the court. And because some members of the court may share my concern, what you just heard is not really elucidating very clearly any legal issue at all before the court. But before I do that, I would like to make one thing abundantly clear to all the members of the court with which I disagree most strongly with Mr. Holloway. It is true that Judge Ryan in this case purported to make findings of fact as to matters which were not without substantial controversy or some similar language, and it's in the papers that we've brought forward to you. We objected to that, and we have set forth in our papers what we think the undisputed facts are. Mr. Holloway takes the position that because a trial judge in a summary judgment proceeding purports to make findings of fact, that they are binding in some way on this court in an original proceeding. I know of no authority for that, but I have tried to set forth in our brief as carefully as I can what the actual undisputed facts in this case are. Of course, it's axiomatic. This court cannot, in an original proceeding, undertake to determine facts. Now, it seems to me...
Are you saying that Judge Ryan proceeding was a summary judgment?
It was a summary judgment proceeding. He sustained Mr. Holloway's 12th motion for summary judgment, refused to hear our motions for summary judgments, pleas and abatement, or pleas to the jurisdiction, and proceeded to act on the 12th motion for summary judgment of, I think, 15 motions for summary judgment that were pending at that time. As preposterous as that sounds, that's what the record before you shows. I think he had the same understanding of jurisdiction Mr. Holloway does.
Did he render a fact finding?
He purported to. Actually, of course, Mr. Holloway was the draftsman, the scrivener. But there is a finding by Judge Ryan in a summary judgment case of facts which purport to be without substantial controversy or some similar bromide, in which this judge purported to find facts of that type or unfind facts in a summary judgment proceeding. I've never seen that done, Judge Ray. I don't understand that. I'm not telling you I understand it. I'm telling you what the man did. Justice Kilgarland elucidated to me what is the, for want of a better term, seminal issue in this case. All these contentions that Mr. Holloway has made about consolidation orders, transfer orders, orders of the presiding district judge, and all these matters were a part of the appeal that Mr. Holloway filed in the Dallas Court of Appeals in this case following the jury trial, where a jury determined Mr. Holloway's misconduct and torts against the Browning family. All those issues were presented in the Court of Appeals brief. Those are before you. You judicially know them anyway because you've seen this case several times. All those matters were before the Dallas Court of Appeals. The Dallas Court of Appeals made three very important holdings when it dismissed Mr. Holloway's appeal. I might tell you what Mr. Holloway did so you have some flavor for why the court did that, and in case you've forgotten why you affirmed it by refusing to hear it. Mr. Holloway, not contenting himself with the state appellate process at that time, went over into the federal courts and assailed the validity of the entire state process as being unconstitutional and a violation of federal law, and was successful in obtaining an adjudication to that effect from District Judge Barefoot Sanders. Judge Sanders declared the entire judgment void as a matter of federal bankruptcy law. Then Mr. Holloway came back to the state courts, back to the Dallas Court of Appeals, and said, now you proceed to decide my appeal. And if you rule for me, I'll agree with you and affirm that. And if you rule against me, I'll ignore you. The Dallas Court of Appeals said that that conduct was not consistent with the integrity of the Texas judicial system, and it constituted a trifling with the state courts, leaving a litigant to select whether he would abide the solemn judgment of a court or not. So the Dallas Court of Appeals held three things. All of them are vitally important. Mr. Holloway doesn't want to discuss them, but I bet the court will want to know what they are. First, they held as a matter of fact and law that the district court had jurisdiction. In spite of all Mr. Holloway's contentions about transfer and consolidation and orders between judges, the Dallas Court of Appeals held the district court, had jurisdiction.
Which one?
Both of them. 162nd and the 193rd, although the final case was in the 162nd, which Mr. Holloway says was also void in response to the Chief Justice's question. It held that it had jurisdiction, and it held that the complaints that Mr. Holloway made were not matters relating to jurisdiction under state law, but were instead related to matters of procedure, that is, transfers and whether transfers were proper and consolidations were proper, and they did not deprive the court of jurisdiction. That's a very important holding because, as all the members of this court know, the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals is derivative. If the district court didn't have jurisdiction to render the judgment complained of, then the Court of Appeals couldn't acquire any. So that holding was important. And that's the first holding that Mr. Holloway wants to ignore. The Dallas Court of Appeals, in a special panel, held that the district court, in this case, this judgment that you're talking about, that you were asking about, Justice Gonzalez, had jurisdiction to render that judgment. Secondly, the Dallas Court of Appeals said that as a sanction for trifling with the state judicial system and for besmirching the integrity of the system as he had, that his appeal would be dismissed and that none of the points of error or assignments of error that he had raised, other than the jurisdictional issues, would be addressed or considered by the court. And finally, and third,
under what?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Then existing rule of that?
sanction order made?
There was no existing rule. That's one of about five cases in the history of Texas where an appeal's ever been dismissed as a sanction. The other, the case that was before it was Strange versus Strange. We cite that in our brief. I can't remember where I was now.
The third point
that the Court of Appeals made, which I think is an extremely important point, was that to enforce and effectuate that sanction, Mr. Holloway would not be receiving any more legal review in the Texas judicial system, and that he would be relegated, in accordance with his selected election of remedies, to the federal forum for the relief available to him there. Now, that was the judgment of the Dallas Court of Appeals. This court reviewed that judgment. This court refused error. This court thereby had to affirm, as it did in Foursquare Gospel and the other cases regarding its own jurisdiction, that the determination of jurisdiction was correct. Otherwise, this court would have been obliged sua sponte to correct the situation. Mr. Holloway went further. He went to the Supreme Court of the United States, and the Supreme Court of the United States reviewed the matter and determined, by denying certiorari, that there was no reversible error of constitutional significance in the court, in this court's judgment, or in the judgment of the court below. Now, what did Judge Ryan purport to do in this case? Mr. Holloway, this case will be over, by the way, Justice Gonzalez, when Mr. Holloway wins, and not otherwise. Mr. Holloway was not content to abide the result of that decision, so he filed a collateral attack in Lee County before Judge Plocky. This court may read its opinion in its own mandamus where it reversed Judge Plocky's purported determination of this collateral attack. It said he had no jurisdiction to do that, and the order that he had entered was incorrect. Mr. Holloway says that authorizes a collateral attack elsewhere. If you read the opinion and believe that, please let me know.
There's music in the courtroom, and that's not permissible. Go ahead, proceed.
If you read your opinion in Browning versus Plocky, and you think that it authorizes Mr. Holloway to file collateral attacks on this theory, I can only tell you that I don't know of anybody that could read it that way. But Mr. Holloway reads it that way. I read it to say that Judge Plocky was ordered to vacate that order. And I read it to say the Supreme Court of Texas very clearly said that Judge Plocky had declared void a judgment which was not shown to have been rendered by a court without jurisdiction of the parties of the subject matter. And it was erroneous and should be vacated. But anyway, not content with that adverse result, he then files yet another proceeding in the form of a, quote, bill of review and a collateral attack in the original case, which is assigned to Judge Ryan for decision. Judge Ryan makes three decisions. He holds the case for 2 years, will not hear any of the Brownings motions, will not hear any of our jurisdictional challenges, proceeds to hear one section of the 12th motion of Mr. Holloway for summary judgment, and makes three decrees. Number one, he finds that contrary to the determination of the Dallas Court of Appeals in this court, that the district court in the original case did not have jurisdiction.
What year is this, counsel? I'm just trying to follow your chart. Where are we in all this?
Yeah, this is very recent. Brown versus Ryan, the original.
Oh, wait, no, your last.
Was 4/13/88 was Judge Ryan's judgment.
Where's the 2 years? Sir, that doesn't look like 2 years on that chart.
No, sir. I'm talking about right here at the tail end. We've been in this case. We're really going into the second decade.
But you said Judge Ryan held it for 2 years.
Yes, sir. He held it for 2 years.
So that line that you showed a little bit in 88 is not correct.
We didn't try to show you the whole length of the case, just the orders. If we put all the lines on here, Your Honor, at least long, we'd have to have a chart 3 times this long. I'll leave this one with you, but you can satisfy yourself. It's right out of the record. It's right out of a brief. It's just a blow-up so you can see.
Well, this doesn't show when cases were filed. It does show for most when cases were filed.
It's in there.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I can't remember where I was again now. Anyway, Judge Ryan does three things in this judgment. He purports to say that the Dallas Court of Appeals erred in determining the district court had jurisdiction. This court erred in failing to reverse that determination, and so he proceeds to hold just the opposite. Secondly, he holds that apparently, according to his findings of facts without substantial controversy, whatever that is, that in fact the holding of the Dallas Court of Appeals as a sanction that this appeal would be dismissed is of no meaning and has no meaning whatsoever.
Funny stuff, you know, and I think one of the problems that Chief Justice has is what you have furnished us here for some reason that not incorporate the Browning versus Ryan line. It ends with Holloway versus Starnes. And down beneath where you give the history, we don't have the history on Browning versus Ryan
That charge,
that's not the same one.
Report to this charge.
Okay. Then this is the chart that adds up lines. I stand corrected on that, and if you want, we can submit that to you separately.
So all we really don't know.
Monitor value to show you anyway. The purpose of showing you this chart is all of you were experienced dry lawyers, we have a bench anyway, just so you can get some idea of how Mr. Holloway operates and why the Dallas Court of Appeals felt it necessary to enjoin him. Because every time he loses a case, he refiles two or three more cases incorporating the same issues in other courts.
Mr. Murto points out to me, Your Honor, that in our answering brief in this case, 7865, facing page 12, is a correct copy of this chart. I stand corrected. I told you we didn't give you the right one. We were right. It's on facing page 12. The only reason we're giving you this is so you can understand, if this litigation is ever going to end, why somebody has to put a stop to it.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, Mr. Holloway is correct when he says that the court has no jurisdiction. That matter can be raised at any time. You don't disagree with that, do you?
Well, I'm not sure that I understand what he says. What I heard him say was a little different than what you just said. He said that an affirmance of a void judgment imparts no validity to it, and he can continue to attack it, even if the court determines that there was jurisdiction. And I do disagree with that.
Right.
That is incorrect. This court specifically and emphatically rejected that in Middleton versus Murr. But as you know, and I assume that's the reason for your question, that began in McEwen versus Harrison and Dean versus Kirk. Mr. Holloway's cases that he refers to, as you know, Justice Kilgarland, are all cases back around Civil War times, when we didn't have rules of civil procedure.
Even more recently, in cases involving when a judge is disqualified under the Constitution.
Certainly. Yes, that's right.
You said that can be raised. It doesn't have to be raised at the trial court. It doesn't have to be raised at the Court of Appeals. You can raise it for the first time in the Supreme Court.
That's all. That's correct.
There's no jurisdiction there.
That's correct.
My question is, though, is this void or is it voidable? And I haven't heard any. I have not heard any one address that.
Well, I'll be pleased to speak to that as best I understand it, because I do not understand what Mr. Holloway said to you. I'll frankly tell you that. But I think I understand McEwen. I think I understand Dean. I think I understand Middleton versus Murr.
Well, what's the date on Middleton versus Murr?
1980, I believe, Your Honor. If I understand that question, essentially what those cases say is that the court has jurisdiction. If you want to determine the jurisdiction of the person, of course, it's personal service. Mr. Holloway doesn't dispute that he was personally served. So the next question would be jurisdiction of the subject matter. Dean makes clear what was referred to in McEwen versus Harrison by that concept, in which you built on in Middleton versus Murr. And indeed, this court says when we say jurisdiction of the subject matter, we mean that the court has jurisdiction to hear the general class of case in which is pending before it. So it gave an example. If a county court purported to render a judgment in a suit for divorce, it would be doing so without jurisdiction of the subject matter. Now, therefore, as I understand the law, Justice Kilgarland, that being the case, that there's jurisdiction over his person, and the 162nd Judicial District Court has general subject matter jurisdiction of lawsuits involving defalcating lawyers and breaching trustees. Therefore, as a matter of law, the only error that the District Court could render under those circumstances would necessarily be voidable. That is to say, erroneous. A ruling of law that is erroneous. But how it could be void under traditional Texas concepts of voidness, I do not understand. And I don't think, I haven't heard anything that elucidates how it would be. But I don't find it necessary, just like you didn't find it necessary in Middleton versus Murph to address that, I don't find it necessary here either. Because the Dallas Court of Appeals did address that in the dismissal. They found that these matters did not involve jurisdictional issues, they involved procedural questions, not jurisdictional, and found the district court had jurisdiction. I'm sorry, did you have a question?
No, I'm just trying to get it all straight.
Well, I apologize to you because I'm sure you're buried in paper, but I hope that what I'm telling you is that this case is a lot more lengthy and complicated than it really is necessarily difficult to resolve.
But if a sanction matter, the court fails to reach the merits of whether or not the trial judge violated state rules or local rules or religious version. Once, you're saying once we in the next Supreme Court refused to look at that, then even if that was entirely wrong.
Well, I say, Chief Justice Phillips, that's not my reasoning. That's the Supreme Court of the United States reasoning in the National Hockey League case. And the reasoning was that when you sanction a litigant and you deny them rights that they would otherwise have, that
comports with
due process and the administration of
justice.
Wait, otherwise, this is what Mr. Holloway seeks. He seeks more and additional rights, you see, even though he was sanctioned, than other litigants have.
By Mr. Holloway's analysis, it's a good idea to get your appeal struck because then you can collaterally attack the judgments so I didn't deny.
And that, of course, is not the law and never has been.
Mr. Holloway made all these arguments before you came on the court. They were all raised to this court in the application for writ of error.
And they were all raised to the Supreme Court of the United States on those very grounds that you just enunciated.
And they were rejected as a matter of
state and constitutional law.
I assume that because
had they been otherwise, they would have been
reviewed and they would have
been written on. To get back to your point, Justice Kilgarland.
Well, I have one question. I won't promise I'm clear, but I'll do a little better. Judge Ryan's orders.
Yes, sir.
We go to Judge Ryan's orders?
Yes,
sir. What did the court, the Dallas Court of Appeals do? They vacated and him from, okay. There's not a appellate right anywhere here by then.
Ah, now that's the issue I understand.
All right. Judge Ryan purported to undo the Dallas Court of Appeals judgment of dismissal. Mr. Holloway said,
I think you said there's no judgment by the Dallas Court of Appeals,
just an order of dismissal.
Did he say that?
An order of dismissal is a judgment. An order of dismissal that
in court
with prejudicial effect.
It's a judgment.
Just the same as any other judgment. But aside from that, Judge Ryan purported to say that the district court did not have jurisdiction.
Holloway was not limited to his remedies
in the federal court and could proceed to collaterally attack the judgment.
That's what Judge Ryan purported to Holloway.
What Judge Ryan signed and
Mr. Holloway wrote.
The Dallas Court of Appeals
said, just as it said in its original
opinion, you were attempting to relitigate a matter which was before us
or could have been
before us.
We will not allow that relitigation. You are attempting to collaterally attack a judgment in this court which we have already determined as a final, valid, binding judgment. We will not allow it. Further, your efforts to relitigate the validity of this judgment, I think there was,
have reached absurd proportions
and have advanced from conflict
representation of the client to absurdity.
And we're now going to enjoin further efforts to attack the validity of this judgment in the state court.
That was the Dallas
court. Did you take an appeal from Judge Ryan's letter?
That's what I'd like to talk about. After the first thing we did, I told you he wouldn't rule on any of our motions. And you remember before Jones versus Strauss, the last case you wrote on prohibition from this court, says prohibition doesn't lie until the trial court manifests a refusal. Indicates a willingness to interfere with this court's judgment or the judgment of the superior court. So we have to wait until he actually does something wrong.
Merely the pendency
of the court can't justify us in seeking prohibition. So we wait.
We ask Judge Ryan to hear our case.
We ask him to decide the case. He won't do it. Then he comes down and rules.
When he rules, we immediately go to the Court of Appeals
and we file an application
for
emergency writs of prohibition,
injunction, and
mandamus,
and to stay.
They grant a stay the same day.
May take it under advisement,
and that led to the opinion that's
before you now.
After the case was argued, after all that had happened, Mr. Holloway hustles over to the federal court, never content to let one court decide the case. We always play one system against the other. He hops it over to
Judge Sanders
and says,
you should now reverse
all your rulings because
I have a judgment from the state court that under the Supreme Court
has a decision
in Scurlock is entitled to immediate preclusive effect,
which is one of the things
Judge Kilgarland, I think, warned about.
And
therefore, it should be given immediate preclusive effect and I should win in the federal court. Not because I'm right, but because the state court had determined. Because it's a little confusing. After this original proceeding was submitted to the court, after they had heard argument on it and had issued their stay, they were not going to rule, apparently were not going to rule by the time that our appeal ran. That is, the time for our appeal ran. So we filed a notice of appeal, and we timely filed our brief. Mr. Holloway filed a motion, which we did not oppose. He didn't want to file a brief because the same issues were presented in the original proceeding. And we felt that they would probably be consolidated because they're the identical issues in this case. But the point I thought you were making was there adequate remedy by appeal? The answer was clearly not. He had gone to the federal court and had said, and correctly, I think, as a matter of Texas substantive law, that Scurlock entitled him to cert in federal court the immediate preclusive effect of that voidness judgment. In addition, there were a lot of other exigent circumstances regarding the effect that ruling had on the company,
on its ability to borrow money, its ability to operate. Mr. Holloway immediately proclaimed himself the new owner of the Humble Exploration Company, HECI, and so forth and so on. But, I mean, that's all before you in the record.
Well, one more question. Did the Dallas court, in fact, consolidate the appeal, or does it still...
They did not, and they issued, to confuse you more, they issued a very strange order here last week. I think the judge that was on the motion panel must not have been aware of your stay and issued an order out of the appeal back to Judge Ryan to vacate his orders in conformance with the original opinion. I just think that was an error. We had already, by the way, filed a motion with the court asking them not to do that when they issued that order. But the effect of the decision, in our view, and we say this in our brief, is essentially the same. No competent lawyer in this situation who has argued an original proceeding would fail to perfect his client's appellate rights or allow the appeal time to run because, of course, the Dallas court could have held for any number of reasons we weren't entitled to an original proceeding relief, in which case we would have been relegated to our relief by appeal. But what I was concerned about was that the court says, well, you've got an appeal here. Why didn't you just prosecute your appeal? And the answer to that is your case of Jones versus Strauss. First off, we didn't have an appeal to begin with. We went to the original proceeding, and frankly, I would have hoped we could have prevailed before the time for appeal ran, but I understand the system is slow. But in Jones versus Strauss, this court said that's the office of a writ of prohibition. The judgment is the prize every litigant seeks, and the finality of that judgment is what makes this bench sit here solid. If judgments don't have finality, then this court might as well, you know, take up another line of work. Because that's all it can do is render final judgment or determine.
I don't want to impose on the Chief Justice if he has any more
questions. I'm sure I've asked enough.
You're finally getting around to what I thought was the issue in this case. Now, sometimes the court has a different view of what the issue in a case is than the litigants. I'm going to pose what I thought was the issue in the case, and it's a very narrow issue, and that is whether or not there is a judgment of the Dallas Court of Appeals existing that thereby authorizes the Dallas Court of Appeals to issue a writ of prohibition. Now, would you first agree with me, and if you don't, tell me you don't, that unless the Dallas Court of Appeals has a judgment, then they have no right to issue a writ of prohibition to protect that judgment if there is no judgment?
Well, I would, with the qualification, Justice Kilgarland, when you talk on the Supreme Court of Texas, you've got to be careful about your terms. I would say judgment or order disposing of a matter with prejudice. They're the same thing to me.
Well,
I think that, to be entirely candid with you, the order, it was an order of dismissal with an opinion.
Doesn't that, when it's an order of dismissal, merely say that the trial court judgment is the judgment in the case? We are dismissing the appeal, thereby the trial court judgment is a judgment in the case. If that is true, and I don't expect you to concede this, but if that is true, hasn't the Dallas Court of Appeals exceeded its authority in granting a writ of prohibition, as they did in response to your petition for mandamus there against Judge Ryan? Haven't they exceeded their authority, because they really have? It's not their judgment, it's the trial court's judgment, and they can't issue a writ of prohibition as to the trial court's judgment. Isn't that really the issue in this case we have before us right now?
Until you articulated it in that fashion, I didn't think it was, and I don't think it is, in all fairness. But
what do you think is the issue?
Well, I thought the issue was whether the Dallas Court of Appeals was justified and appropriate in issuing the writs that it did, and I understand now there's a different light on that. Let me respond to your question. The Dallas Court of Appeals had before it a very lengthy appeal, about three times as much stuff as you have right here.
Now, wait. We've had at least two things go to that court. Are you talking about appeal from the original 82 judgment, or
yes,
are you talking about the mandamus action you brought against Judge Ryan?
No, sir. I'm sorry. Let me clear that up.
Okay.
I'm talking about the original appeal that Pat Holloway filed from the original judgment. That was what they had before them. Now, the issue that was presented there was whether the court, and it's in the opinion, I know you've read the opinion, but it's stated very clearly by Judge Keith. Judge Keith wrote the opinion. Judge Keith said, we have before us this voluminous record that we're prepared to decide. They were specially appointed by the Chief Justice, Judge Hill, to hear this case. And now neither side wants us to decide it. Mr. Holloway wants to put the case off and continue it. Brownings want us to dismiss it. And then he proceeds to analyze what the situation is. I think it is incorrect to say that the dismissal of the appeal did not operate to determine the jurisdiction of the trial court because the opinion says otherwise. And if that were the effect of it, Justice Kilgarland, then you see the Court of Appeals' opinion would be a nullity and would be meaningless. In order for the Court of Appeals to be able to dismiss the appeal, they had to determine that the trial court had jurisdiction. Because if the trial court didn't have jurisdiction, then the Court of Appeals didn't acquire any, and they should have dismissed the case. That's my point. I'm not trying to quibble with you least of all, but I'm just trying to say to you that they did have an order of dismissal, and they had an opinion, and they implemented it as a sanction. They refused to hear the merits of the appeal because of this man's conduct, and they dismissed his appeal. They determined that the court below had jurisdiction, and that was their order. Now, what I've told you is a combination of the opinion they wrote and the order that they entered. And I might add, in all fairness to me, that is exactly what the Dallas Court of Appeals determined it said and meant in this case. And now I'm not talking about the original appeal. I'm talking about in this mandamus. Well, that's exactly what the Dallas Court said.
Okay, if they had dismissed because the trial court didn't have jurisdiction, that's a horse of one color, but if they dismissed as a sanction, and
that imparts res judicata effect.
That's
exactly what the Chief Justice asked, and that's right. When a court dismisses a case as a sanction, it imparts the same degree of finality for res judicata purposes.
That's not true, and if you're talking about dismissal, let's say the court imposes a sanction of dismissal of a cause without prejudice.
Certainly.
There is clear case law that says that does not operate as a final judgment.
I agree with that.
But if you dismiss with prejudice, that is the same as a take-nothing judgment.
That's exactly what the Dallas Court of Appeals did in this case. The Dallas Court of Appeals in this case, and we cited the cases to you in our papers, that the dismissal of an appeal operates as an affirmance of the trial court's judgment. That's settled law in this state. It has been for me. But I emphasize to you, my time has expired, but if I may finish this thought. What I want to emphasize to you is the Dallas Court of Appeals dismissed this appeal as a sanction. And they wrote an opinion. There's nothing that's dicta about their opinion. Their opinion sets forth very clearly what they did and why they did it. And they were enforcing that judgment and order of dismissal in these proceedings.
Do we have case authority on this point, or is this such a rare instance where an appellate court makes an order of dismissal on these grounds that we're more or less in a new area?
Ethical responsibilities bother me.
We can overrule the law.
Okay. Well, I, if you all couldn't, I don't know who could.
Right.
I don't want to be in a position of collaterally attacking that last. So. If I understand the court, there are other cases in which the courts of Texas have taken similar action. The one that I can call to mind right now from my memory is the case I alluded to before, Strange versus Strange. Very briefly, to tell you what that case held, and I think we cited it. If we don't, we'll get you a short letter brief on that if you want us to try to find those cases. The Strange case involved a litigant who had been in a child custody case and spirited the child outside the jurisdiction of Texas and then purported to appeal. In other words, was going to hold the child outside the state's jurisdiction and simultaneously use the state's judicial machinery to appeal. And the Fort Worth court said, if you don't bring the child back to the jurisdiction so that you're going to abide by our decision, then we're going to dismiss your appeal. He didn't bring the child back, they dismissed the appeal. That's Strange versus Strange. There are other ones.
But have any of these ever had a test, presumably it would have to be from this court, as to the nature of that dismissal order, as far as whether it constitutes a separate judgment of the Court of Appeals or whether it is merely in the nature of an abandonment of the right of appeal, as it were, leaving people with the trial court judgment as the final.
Well, I hesitate to refer you to another member of the court. The person that I have read the most written on the subject of sanctions in that area is Justice Kilgarland, and it is my understanding that where the court orders as a sanction dismissal with prejudice, that is, denial of further rights with the prejudice of the ability to refile them, that it has that effect. But to answer you honestly, Mr. Chief Justice, I do not know of a case that this court has decided on point. I'll be happy to research the question.
We're talking about a very narrow thing when we talk about Court of Appeals opinions and the jurisdiction there, as I mean, it's not necessarily analogous to the trial court.
It would strike me as wholly illogical, if I may say so. It would strike me as wholly illogical for the Court of Appeals to be able to enter a judgment dismissing an appeal as a sanction and saying we're not going to allow you to litigate this further in the state courts because you've that egregiously violated the courts in this state. And then for someone to say, if they did, that the court didn't have the authority to enforce that order if somebody purported to do it anyway. That's what this case is about. And I hope, if we need any authority for that, Your Honor, I hope you'll write it for us in this case. I think that, however, the authority is there already. Court of Appeals has got to have the authority to enforce its judgments and orders, just like this court does.
It's inherent power.
I would hope so, and you said that in Jones versus Strauss. You said that when they purport to do that, when they purport to relitigate in Jones, even by implication, something you decided, this court would act sua sponte if necessary to enforce it by prohibition. I hope I answered your question.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Do you want us to submit something post-submission on?
We do not. I don't see.
I don't think anybody ever raised
it. Or Strange versus Strange in your brief.
May I have leave to do that? We might also like leave to respond. Mr. Holloway filed something here the day before yesterday, I think. I'd like to read that and have leave to respond to it if I might as well. We can get you.
Well, I'm sorry to say 7 days, but we're heading into Christmas. Why don't we make it 10?
Well, whatever's convenient. We understand your convenience is more important than ours. You want 7 or 10? We'll get it in 7.
All right.
Thank you very much.
First, Your Honor, I don't think it's correct that the Court of Appeals dismissed my direct appeal from the Walker judgment as a sanction. What they said was that I had elected to appeal to the federal courts, and having elected to appeal to the federal courts, I was entitled to only one appeal, and that it was too much of a burden on the Brownings to have to put up with two appeals. So having elected to appeal, is what they said, to the federal courts, they were restricting me to that appeal in the federal courts. Now,
why wouldn't that judgment or order or whatever it is be something which this court then had the opportunity and did review in your direct appeal from that CA opinion and judgment to this court?
Well, that judgment is final and that ruling is final, but that does not, the dismissal of an appeal, just like the failure to take an appeal does not preclude a collateral attack, and the taking of an appeal and an unsuccessful appeal does not preclude a bill of review, a direct attack by bill of review.
Well, I guess we have two questions here that are really threading through this case, at least, probably more. One is was the action of Judge Walker in taking jurisdiction of this case wholly void so that that can be anything that happened from that point on is void and can be attacked at some later time, and then the question is at what later time and how. And then the second question is this, more narrowly tailored just to this circumstances, did the Court of Appeals issue a judgment upon which it could then enforce a writ of prohibition against Judge Ryan sitting special in 162nd? But those seem to me to be two questions, and we principally heard from you about the first question during your earlier presentation.
Well, let me address your last question there, whether or not the order of dismissal of the Dallas Court of Appeals was an order that it can enforce by prohibition. And the answer to that is clearly no. And the two cases are International Harvester versus Fitch, which is a decision by this court in 1962, 354 Southwest 2nd, 372. Here's what the court said there. The Court of Appeals dismissed the appeal to this court for want of prosecution, to that court for want of prosecution. That action was not erroneous under the ruling because they didn't file a brief. The appeal having been dismissed, discussion by the Court of Appeals of the merits of the appeal and its affirmance of the trial court's judgment may be regarded as mere surplusage, inasmuch as the judgment of the trial court stands unimpaired upon the dismissal of the appeal.
Give me this case site on that.
354 Southwestern 2nd, 372.
What's the style again?
Fitch versus International Harvester Company. What this court said there is the dismissal. What the Court of Appeals did was they said, we're going to dismiss your appeal because you didn't file your brief on time. But then they looked at his brief and said, but anyway, your brief's wrong anyway, so we're affirming the court. we're affirming the judgment of the court below. And this court says, wait a minute, when you dismiss the appeal, your discussion of the merits of the appeal are mere surplusage and can be disregarded.
In what context did the Supreme Court say that? Did they reverse and send back for a trial?
Did the Supreme Court?
Yes.
No, this was on application for writ of error to this court, and the court was just correcting what the Court of Appeals... I beg your pardon?
What action did the Supreme Court take?
It refused the writ of error, but it cleared up. It corrected the opinion of the Court of Appeals. What the Court of Appeals was trying to do was do both. Dismiss the appeal and affirm. And the Supreme Court says, you can't do that. You can either dismiss or affirm, but you've dismissed, and once you've dismissed, any discussion of the merits of the appeal is mere surplusage because the trial court's judgment remains unimpaired. You see, the Brownies claim this was an affirmance. If it was an affirmance, then the judgment of the trial court becomes the judgment of the Court of Appeals, and it can enforce it by writ of prohibition. But where the appeal is dismissed, it remains, it's still the trial court's judgment, because the only judgment the Court of Appeals has is to dismiss the appeal. And the only prohibition, if I brought the Walker judgment down here to the Third Court of Appeals and said, I want to appeal down here because they won't let me in the Dallas Court of Appeals, then the Dallas Court of Appeals could issue a writ of prohibition and say, hey, we've decided your appeal was dismissed. That is preclusive. You are impinging on our judgment. You're trying to appeal to Judge Shannon's court here. That there you would have a writ of prohibition. That's not what happened. The other
Holloway, case, let us assume hypothetically that the court agrees with you that the Dallas Court of Appeals has exceeded its authority because it has no judgment to protect by writ of prohibition. Does that merely mean that Mr. Ayers is limited to an appeal from whatever judgment that Judge Ryan should ultimately render in this case?
Does it mean that he's limited to an appeal? No, Your Honor. I think that this court, under the Strait case, clearly should decide whether or not the rulings of Judge Ryan are correct or not.
Well, now, that doesn't come to us in mandamus. That would come to us on an appeal, wouldn't it, or a writ of error.
That's all right. How can a district judge purport to make findings of fact in a summary judgment case?
Your Honor, he did not do so. He's making fun of Judge Ryan. Mr. Ayers asked him to make fact. He, as soon as he said he was sustaining the motion for partial summary judgment, they sent a letter to him and demanded verbally that he file findings of fact.
Well, he's accusing you of drafting those findings and drafting the order.
I beg your pardon?
He's accusing you of drafting the findings and the order. Of that order that was signed.
Yes, but they are not findings of fact.
Did you make those findings? Were you the scrivener of that order?
I drafted it, and he signed it at his request. The Browning said, we want you to file findings of fact and conclusions of law. I said, Your Honor, I don't think it is appropriate in a summary judgment proceeding to have findings of fact. It's just like he said, it's not appropriate. He said, well, but the Brownings want us to specify the fact. I said, well, you can do that. You can specify. Rule subsection D of Rule 166A says specifically, when a trial judge sustains a partial motion for summary judgment, he shall enter an order specifying the facts that exist without substantial controversy. The rule requires that. So all Judge Ryan did was do what was required by the rule.
Now, did Judge Ryan ever sever? I mean, did he enter what purported to be a final summary judgment? That's the first time it was part of
it. Well, then I moved to sever, and they wanted to sever too so they could go up on appeal. Mm-hmm. So he severed and entered the final judgment without objection from them, and he did enter a final judgment following his findings of fact and conclusions of law so that they could appeal, but they went by mandamus at the same time.
If those are findings and conclusions, we just don't look at them. If they're not, if there's something else.
They are specifications. They are specifications of uncontroverted facts. And if the case comes up on appeal, it'll come up on those facts. They did not request any additional findings, Justice Gonzalez. They didn't make any objections to his specification of fact. They disagreed with his conclusions of law. And in their pending appeal to the Dallas Court of Appeals, they have no point of error about his specification of uncontroverted fact. And the rules specifically authorize the procedure that Judge Ryan followed. One other case, Your Honor, that I did not, Justice Kilgarland, All Men's Reciprocal Association versus Coe, is a Eastland Court of Appeals opinion, writ refused, 1930, which says as follows: in accordance with the opinion of the former appeal, the case was dismissed because the judgment appealed from was not final. In our former opinion, we discussed the proposition of appellants on their merits. Since the appeal was dismissed, that portion of our opinion does not have the effect of an adjudication by this court. So what that means, and that was a writ refused case, that's an opinion for all purposes of this court.
What's the site on that?
29 Southwestern 2nd, 430. So what that means is the dismissal, everything that the Court of Appeals said in the direct appeal is mere surplusage, and it does not have the effect of an adjudication. So what we have is a district court judgment that has never been reviewed by any appellate court and which is void for subject matter, loss of subject matter jurisdiction.
And just to get it straight one more time, I know you're running out of time, but you're saying it's void because in violation of the Dallas local rules, Judge...
No, Your Honor, I'm saying it's void because it violates Article 200A and 200B. 200A...
Why, under McKeown versus Harrison, would that make a judgment void? I mean, we've held it to... Wrong venue isn't void. Yeah, wrong venue isn't void now. It's just automatically reversible under the statute.
That's right, Your Honor. But these McKeown, these cases that he's citing are cases where the party tried to set aside a judgment as void by motion filed in the original cause. That's Middleton versus Murr that he relies on. And all it says is that regardless of whether it's void or voidable, the only way to set it aside in the court which rendered the judgment is by a separate suit. You cannot do that by motion filed in the original action after the court has lost jurisdiction under Rule 329B. Those were all 329B cases. And as far as whether it's void or voidable, those cases show that it's void because this court has repeatedly held that a motion for new trial, a motion filed after the court's plenary jurisdiction of the particular case has lapsed because of the time limitations in Rule 329B, any judgment entered after that time by the court is absolutely void. It's void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The court had jurisdiction over the particular class of case. It had jurisdiction over that case, but it lost jurisdiction of the subject matter of that case when the time for rehearing under Rule 329 expired.
Aren't you extending this now? Not only are you contending that there was no judgment of the Court of Appeals for which it could issue a writ of prohibition, based on these two cases you cited, now you're saying that there was no trial court judgment because it was void on which anything could be prohibited. That's really what you're asking us to rule, and isn't that exceeding the office of mandamus?
I think this court can rule. I think this court can rule whether Ryan's conclusions of law are correct or not. But this court has repeatedly issued mandamus against court actions that violated a statute, Heard versus State Bar, or were such an abuse of discretion because the court didn't have jurisdiction. I think if I'm right about the law, then this court could have issued a mandamus against Judge Ryan requiring him to set the Judge Walker judgment aside. Let me refer the court, I don't remember the citation, but Fulton versus Finch, a decision by this court, said, where a court has purported to set aside a prior judgment after the time for filing a motion for rehearing had expired. That action by the district court in reinstating its prior judgment is void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, lots of cases holding.
And can be, well, the point of that is it's not, as they say, just void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction means two things, can be two things. The court does not have any potential jurisdiction over the general class of cases, like a probate court can't try a murder case. But it can also mean jurisdiction over the particular case. And my position, which is very simple, is that these assignments of the specific case by the presiding judge of the administrative district and the final adjudication in front of the presiding judge of the Dallas County District Court, that Judge Walker did not have subject matter jurisdiction, that judgment, which has never been appealed and never been collaterally attacked, is entitled to preclusive collateral estoppel effect. The parties all appeared before the presiding judge. He had the power to decide who had jurisdiction of the case.
Now, which judge decided it?
That was Judge Meade.
Meade, okay.
Judge Meade. He was the acting Dallas County District presiding judge. Under Section 4 of Article 200B, he specifically had the power to assign and transfer cases.
Nobody else could decide that but him, is what you're saying. The fact that Walker tried to do it, Walker's judgment is void.
Is void because the presiding judge had already made a determination that Judge Walker did not have subject matter jurisdiction of the case and ordered it transferred back to the retired judge. I think if he had made any other decision, it would have been erroneous because of the Cleveland versus Ward doctrine that says dominant jurisdiction is in the earliest case file. And because, in addition to the Judge Meade's decision, we had the presiding judge of the administrative district had specially assigned that case to retired Judge Harless to try. And if a district judge can overrule the assignments of presiding judges of the region and of the local multi-district counties, then the statutes are meaningless. There is no effect to be given to the statute. And I submit that a regular district judge simply does not have the power to override orders and judgments of the presiding judge any more than the Dallas Court of Appeals can override this court. Thank you.
Thank you. The court will take another brief recess.